All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. You know, here on the show, we talk about all kinds of things, but all in the world of the strange and the unexplained. My guest this evening has been with us before, and I think a lot of you will remember him, but he is William Warwick IV. He is an author, a researcher, a communicator. He does radio, he does film, and so he has agreed to be with us this evening to talk about a kind of a strange thing, and that is these boomerang-shaped UFOs and a connection, apparently, with Grail families. So I'm very interested in hearing what he's got to say about that. William, welcome to the show again. We're glad to have you.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
For those of you who are watching, that face that you see there is William Warwick IV. And he is he's waving to you there. And so we are anxious now to hear about the boomerang UFOs and any connection with Grail families. Now, what are we talking about with these boomerang UFOs?
It's the shape of the UFO. It is typically, we would call it a boomerang today, but it's probably a proper name. It would be called a chevron. The chevron name itself actually dates back to the 13th and the 14th century, and that was one of the ways that I was able to trace the origins of the shape itself all the way back to the 13th century and then connect the name of the chevron with the people that might have come up with the name of the chevron. Do you understand what I'm saying? So, in other words, I started with the basis of the theory that if with my own experience where I saw the boomerang-shaped UFO in Norfolk, Virginia the day before the Phoenix Lights and worked backwards from there thinking that witnesses in the past would have also seen these shapes in the sky, and of course, as we've talked about before, you know, I'm very firm in the belief that the entire human race has basically got a lot of cargo cult tendencies in the sense that, you know, we tend to try to mimic anything that we see that we can't explain or that we think is special or unique. So basically, tying in the shape of the boomerang with some of the other names of the boomerang, which is chevron, for instance, and then tying that all the way back, you know, to 13th century manuscripts, and then from 13th century manuscripts to 7th century stuff, from 7th century stuff all the way back to, you know, 1st century stuff. And then from there you get into Sumerian history and Akkadian and basically prehistory in a sense, and you can actually trace some of those shapes all the way back to there and beyond. So it really was kind of a journey of self-discovery as much as it was trying to figure out what happened on March 12, 1997 in my own UFO case, but trying to tie this all the way back through history and try to make the connections, which I think I've done pretty well.
Okay, so let's go back to March of 1997. What happened?
Well, I was I was working as a plumber at the time. I was also a junior in college trying to get my degree in BSME in engineering at Old Dominion University. And I went out to, I mean, long story short, of course, went out to my car, truck actually, it was my work truck, to get a business card. On the way back in, I witnessed a 400-foot wide boomerang-shaped object pass in front of the Stars of Orion's belt and then basically make a maneuver or spun around on its own axis and fell a couple thousand feet in about 2 or 3 seconds without breaking the sound barrier, without making any noise, and then continued to proceed like it was on parade in front of me at maybe 20, 25, 35 miles an hour, so slow that, I mean, it just looked like it was hanging there in the sky and made no sound, maybe a very, very deep subsonic hum, which other witnesses have reported as well. But basically, that's what got me involved in this whole thing. It happened on March 12, 1997, which, interesting enough, was the day before the Phoenix Lights, and that's when other witnesses described the same type of object. So my event actually precedes most of the Phoenix Lights events by one day.
Okay. Let me just ask you, if you can, to point your camera down just a little bit. So that'd give us a little bit better shot there. All right. Now, this, the Phoenix Lights, we know happened. Everybody knows that happened in the Phoenix area. Of course, it actually happened over about three states and down into Mexico. So it's not, it's come to be known as the Phoenix Lights, and we all call it that. But yep. Just for accuracy's sake, folks, it wasn't just Phoenix, okay?
Yeah.
It was the whole state of Arizona, as well as part of Utah, and I think part of Nevada. And then it proceeded south on down into Mexico. But this was the day before that, and you're located in what part of the country?
Virginia Beach, Norfolk, Virginia, which is where this happened was actually pretty much surrounded by military bases. And some people take that to mean that it was a military operation or a military craft. And I really investigated that, and there's no evidence that I've been able to find that this was, in fact, a military operation or a military aircraft, because we actually found one helicopter pilot who made a report that basically said that he had followed this object across the bay, and the object had went over the bay, Hampton Bay, from over the Norfolk Naval Base to Langley Air Force Base, which is right over the water in Hampton. And really, if you plot that from the position of where I last saw it, it's a straight line to Langley. So mm-hmm. I have a feeling that that report is true. And I don't know why a military pilot, had to have been a helicopter pilot, would have reported that clandestinely if he didn't actually see it and know about it. Do you know what I'm saying? So I don't think it was a military aircraft. Otherwise, he wouldn't have said anything about it, because he had no clue about it either. He thought he had lost his mind. He probably didn't even report it to his superiors, which most pilots won't. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. All right, so who did he report it to?
That's what I'm saying. I don't think he reported it to anybody. He reported it to, I read the report on Sky, I think it's a defunct UFO reporting agency now that Bill Hamilton used to run.
Okay.
Back in 1997, Skynet or Sky something or other. So it actually didn't, it wasn't a report that I had investigated. It's a report that came in through another UFO agency, through Phoenix. I think it was Bill Hamilton's old group, and I just happened to pick up. It was just like one of those random reports that came through, and I saw it, and I copied it, and I still have a copy of it today. It was the only report that I've ever been able to find. Military report, or actually corroboration report of my sighting, was that particular report that was made to that UFO reporting agency.
How high was this thing when you witnessed it? What was its altitude?
It's difficult to tell because it's a 400-foot wide aircraft, but I mean, I would say, I'm going to say 2,000, maybe 3,000 feet, maybe as high as 5,000, but I doubt it. It's probably somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 feet. And when it passed in front of me, it was about the length of my finger, which is about 3.5, 4 inches. If you hold it up at arm's length, and it passed in front of Orion's belt and blinked each star out individually to give you some idea of depth or, mm-hmm. size. And really, the remarkable thing was how quickly it, just the fact that it dropped in altitude that quickly,
mm-hmm.
I would have had to have broken the sound barrier. And I can understand anti-gravity, I can understand, what do they call it, noise cancellation, but how do you stop the sonic boom when you accelerate that quickly? So whatever propulsion system it's using, it's got to be warping not only its own mass and space-time, so to speak, but do you know what I'm saying? Because if it was a solid object moving through the atmosphere, it would have had to have broken the sound barrier. There's just no way around it. So it must be changing its mass somehow. It's got to be affecting either its own mass, its own gravity, or creating some sort of bubble around it in which it can operate in that environment without actually affecting the molecules around it somehow.
So, all right. So
it was pretty amazing. I mean, it was really like, and the other thing about it too, here's another thing, it didn't have a seam that I could see on it. It was like it was injection molded. And so there was no rivets. And I got a really good view of it. There's a reflection off the front portion of it coming up over sort of the top of the wing top. It had three domes on it. Domes were about 20 feet wide, maybe about 5 feet coming down from the bottom, so they didn't stick out very far at all, down, I should say. And if you were looking at it sideways, it would look like, I'm trying to make the finger sign here, it would look like a flying brick. If you took a rectangular, if you took a cross section out from the side, it would look like a rectangle, just curve the tops a little bit, and that would, and then it turned into a boomerang shape with three domes on the bottom, and that's what it was. So it had no, absolutely no chance of laminar flow. The front leading edge of it was vertical. And it was 25 to 30, it was 35 feet from front to back, like this, and it was 25 feet tall, because I remember comparing it to the size of the house that was in front of me, and that's a 2.5-story tall building. So it's 20 feet up and down, 35 feet front to back, and 400 feet wide, like wingtip to wingtip. So it was a massive piece of equipment. Unbelievable technology. I mean, just
now, were there any other local people who reported having seen it, or were there mentions of it in the news or anything?
No. I have had one person talk to me on the phone, and we've exchanged emails, who actually lived in Norfolk and was in Norfolk at that night. And the funny thing is, this woman, and there was a couple actually, her husband was in the nuclear technology field, and they didn't want to go public with this at all because they were afraid that he would lose his clearance. But basically, this is a kind of funny story. What they told me was that they never saw it, but at 11 o'clock that night, the same night that I saw my UFO in Norfolk, they said that her and her husband heard that sound, which was the woo, 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 like that sound, in their house, and it felt like it's going to shatter their house apart, and there was like stuff, you know, walls were shaking. And they ran out in their car, actually, to go and try and find out where the sound was coming from. And they didn't see it, they could hear it, and they chased it around the neighborhood, but they never saw it.
And did you hear it make that same sound?
Yes, I did, but it was very, very subtle. It was, and I almost, when I recall it, it was like, is that my imagination, or did I actually hear it? And I'm absolutely convinced right now that there's no question I did hear it, because it's what I reported originally. And so, you know, as time goes on, you think, well, is that what really happened? And then you go back to what you originally reported, and you go, oh, okay, yeah, your initial impressions are probably the clearest ones. 15 years down the line, not so good.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was definitely but the funny thing is, it was subsonic. So it wasn't necessarily something that I heard. I felt it. I felt it in my chest. I felt it vibrating my body. But you also have to remember, at this point, and when I had felt or heard it, whatever you want to call it, it was maybe no more than 100 feet above my head, and diagonally, 100 feet away from me. Not necessarily. It did not go above my head. It actually went diagonally about 100 feet at a 45-degree angle from my position, which puts it about literally 10 feet above the streetlights. I mean, it was like floating right above the streetlights and right above the trees and right above the houses. It was really incredible. And it had no effect on any of the streetlights. It had no effect on the trees. There was no whoosh sound. It was just that very faint subsonic hum.
So when you initially saw it, it was 2,000 to 3,000 feet up.
Yes.
And then it just dropped to just above treetop level.
Correct. And when it dropped, you know, a plane dives, it banks, you know, the aerolons down, and it keels over like that. You know, you push the bar down and you go forward. This thing, it turned on a central axis. It had an apex. It's, you know, boomerang. Just think of the middle of the boomerang. And it actually pivoted on that central axis and spun down on a central axis. Like I always call it, when I was a kid, we used to have these, seed pods for maple trees. And we'd throw them up and they would come down.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it did. But it was so fast. It was so fast. I really lost it for. It took about 2 or 3 seconds, and I lost it because 1 second I was up by the stars, passing in front. I'm like, oh, that's really cool. And then I lost it. I'm like, oh, where did it go? And the next thing I know, it's down here floating over, coming out from behind this house, floating in front of me, and then I actually was still kind of totally black at that point. I really couldn't make out any shape or mass. And then what happened is, it got to a certain point on Rogers Avenue where all the streetlights were lined up perpendicular to me, and it passed over the streetlights, and then the streetlights reflected off the bottom of it, and then I realized it wasn't a hang glider, it wasn't a B-2 bomber, Those are the two thoughts I had in my mind before I saw the shape. And then when I saw the shape, initially when the streetlights actually shined off it, all I could see was this. I could only see it from the side. And it actually looked like some kind of upside-down UFO because I could see this, and then I could see the little dome on the bottom or the outline of a dome on the bottom. And then as it kind of moved forward, the right, let me think, yeah, the left wing yard, it lifted up a little bit, and then the light shined on kind of the back end of it, and then I realized it was kind of like a boomerang shape. It wasn't the initial shape that I saw. And then as it passed down in front of me, I got to see it from behind, and when I saw it from behind, I could tell that it was a big, huge, long, wide thing with one dome in the middle underneath it and a dome on each wing underneath it. So that's when I got the width size of it. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I could judge it against it. It was about 400 feet.
All right, your initial impression of this thing, what was your initial impression? That it was probably one of our secret black projects, or that it was probably not from this planet? What was your initial impression as you looked at it?
After it had gone by,
mm-hmm.
or as it was happening?
Either one, whatever your initial impression was.
I was scared.
Were you? Why?
Because I had had some dreams a couple weeks before that I had been taken aboard a UFO, and I was afraid that that was their sign to me that what had happened a couple weeks before wasn't a dream, and that kind of freaked me out, to be honest with you. So
did you determine that you had or had not actually been taken on board?
Man, it's like 50-50. I mean, I've got 50% of me says yeah, and 50% of me says, you know, it was just a coincidence. But, I mean, if it was a dream, it was one of the most powerful few dreams that I've ever had where I've interacted with someone else, number one, that I remembered every single part of it, number two, and that I remembered phrases and things that happened. I mean, it was bizarre. When it actually happened, it freaked me out. This happened actually, let's see, so that was March. It was February 28th. That was the night that the GRB 970028 went off.
All right. We're talking about these boomerang-shaped UFOs at the moment. We're going to connect it up with Grail families here in just a second. But, Bill, I just wanted to make sure that you were able to finish your thought there. We had to, you know, step away for break. Okay, we're not getting any audio from you.
There we go. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically what had happened was on February 28th, 1997, a very peculiar gamma ray burst occurred, and that was 970228, which I'm not going to get too diverged into because I wrote a big paper on that. What also happened was that was also the time that the HARP developmental prototype program also began operating. And one of the interesting things that I kind of correlated with the Phoenix Lights events was that the HARP went operational February 28th and stopped operations on March 14th. And if you look at that time period, that window, it's actually the window where these major UFO events happened all around the world, because just like you pointed out earlier, you have the Norfolk event March 12th, you have the Phoenix events on March 13th, but all around the world, beginning in February, right around February 28th in Moscow, for instance, in Russia, and other countries, you know, you can plot these boomerang sort of flaps that occurred during that two-week period of time. So the question is there a connection between the HARP developmental prototype and the possibly some of these anti-gravity aircraft, if we're making them? Or could possibly the use of these HARP developmental prototype equipment be used to actually monitor and track these aircraft?
Or unmask them?
There's a whole bunch of things you can do with the HARP equipment. You know, obviously, as anyone's kind of looked into it and researched into it. So it all really depends on what you're trying to do with it, what you're going to get out of it. But you could do all of those things. And we should also remember that.
Earlier made the statement that because of this helicopter pilot, military pilot, and his report, you're under the impression that this is not our military stuff, right?
Yeah, no, let me clarify that. I do believe that we have military equipment that's capable of anti-gravity in some form.
Okay.
No question about that.
Uh-huh.
None whatsoever. The question remains, what were the craft that were seen in Phoenix, all of them, some of them or most of them, extraterrestrial? And I'm going to have to say and go on the record and say, and I've said this before, that I believe that we have all three, meaning that I think we had an extraterrestrial visitation. I think that we had some of our man-made alien recovered vehicles have been sent up to intercept them. That we've reached that point in technology, just what Paul Hellyer said repeatedly in the X conference and newspapers and everything else. He's the former Secretary of Defense for Canada. And then you have the third possibility, which is a foreign country actually having this technology as well, and the leading candidate for that would by far be China.
Why not Russia?
It's possible, yes, definitely, because they've obviously recovered a lot of stuff as well, and they're the only nuclear program that would be capable of having the capability to do it. Absolutely, Russia. Sure. I meant to say Russia, too, but I think China, from what I've been hearing or what the scuttlebutt is they've really got a head start on it. And we have to remember that, you know, China took over Tibet, and there's been a lot of sort of speculation about what the Tibetans know about anti-gravity, acoustic levitation, things like that. And we already know that they've got sophisticated super science that they use, like acoustic levitation and stuff like that. That's a scientifically proven fact. So the next question is, you know, what could a civilization that's 2,000 years older than ours, what kind of a head start could they actually really maybe have?
Yeah.
And I think it's very possible that the, you know, obviously the arms race that we have today is actually revolving around the recovered vehicle aspects and who's going to have the, you know, the most amount of power with that. I think the Russians probably dropped out of that a long time ago. I think the Chinese have probably had this technology for a long time since they invented basically every major advancement that we have today. You know, if you really think about it, they invented the printing press, they invented money, they invented, you know, gunpowder, you know what I mean?
And this goes on and on. Spaghetti.
It's spaghetti. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. I would also go to also say that, you know, in America, I think the biggest problem that we have in the deficit is that we've been spending something, when adjusted for inflation, something like a trillion or two or $3 trillion a year on these secret black carbon projects. So if you want to know why it might be possible that the Pentagon office where all those records were kept for accounting, and the $2.3 trillion that's missing from you know, the Pentagon that was announced the day before 9/11, and all of a sudden that records office office of the Navy gets blown up, and those records disappear, and they don't know where the money went. Well, it went somewhere.
Yeah.
Did it disappear? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if you, the funny thing is too, also, and there was a former controller of the United States retired in 2008, and he was on, he actually wrote a book, I don't know the name of it, I forget the gentleman's name, but the former U.S. comptroller of the United States is basically the accountant for the whole entire government. So it's not just the accountant for the Department of State or whatever, it's the accountant for the whole thing. And what he said publicly many times, not just in the book, but actually on television shows, like HBO with, I forget his name, Bill, the comedian there, we're actually $55 trillion in debt, $55 trillion, and that he said that everybody knows it, the major politicians know it, but there's a gag order because they're afraid that if this becomes really publicly known, then the whole economy will just fall apart. And if you start with the premise that this secret black research program started in, say, 1947, and you add 55 years to that, and then you add the current deficit, comes out to about the number of years between now and 1947.
All right. Let's talk about Grail families. What are they, and how are they connected with this phenomena of boomerang-shaped UFOs?
Well, the connection to the Grail families actually started not only with the investigation of trying to find out the connection between the boomerang shapes and their names, which is the chevron, but also in a way trying to figure out what the Grail name itself means. G-R-A-I-L. And as everybody knows, you know, Dan Brown came out with that book, and everyone since then has kind of been really speculating about possible meanings, like he says, Sang Grail, which is French for royal bloodline, or royal blood, which is one possible explanation. But I actually found out that the person who invented the idea of chivalry, where we get the word chevron from, and chevalier, like chevalier is actually the French name for a knight, is from a 13th century manuscript called Tirant le Blanc. It was one of the first novels ever written in history, and it actually centers on a meeting between a traveling knight and a figure known as Count William of Warwick, which of course is my name. So you can imagine how taken aback I was to be sitting here reading an account of a person with the same name as me from the same English town as my ancestors are from, and reading this whole story that I've never heard before. And figuring out that Warwick was the name that was used in the 13th century, which is shortly after the disbanding of the Knights Templar. Now, if you go further back in history, what I found was that Warwick was spelled Guarensis, G-U-A-R-E-N-S-I-S, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, prior to the 7th century, there was no W in the English language. So wherever we see W in any word today that stems from an English word, Old English or Old Germanic or, you know, European, it's actually, you can replace that with G-U prefix, and it can mean the same thing for a lot of words that predate the 7th century.
So we're going to need you to adjust your camera again. We're getting you from the chin up is all. There we go.
Yeah. So for instance, guarantee and warranty, right? Guardian and watcher, that was the big one, okay? And I could go on and on and on. So wherever you see a W, you could put a G-U. Now this becomes interesting because in French, for instance, war, which is the prefix of our name, W-A-R, can be translated as G-U-E-R-R, or guerre, right? So, and then you go into Norman dialects, and then you go into other little European, you know, associated French dialects, or Latin or Romance language dialects. And then what I found was that Grail is a corruption of Guarensis. So, Guarensis, and now let's go back a little bit further. Now, Guarensis ties in with King Arthur, or Arthur, or Artur, and there's three different names that they use because there are different tribes that call them by different names, but one was called Art Gulker, which is another A-R-T-G-U prefix, Art Gulker, Achenu Viros, and then I forget what the other one is. It's been 15 years since I looked at that document. But the bottom line was that that allowed me to connect then the area and perhaps this story of Count William of Warwick to King Arthur and the Arthurian legends and the Arthurian family. Okay? Now, once I got to that point, then we go a little bit further back and find out that there's a tremendous amount of evidence that would suggest that the tales that we have inherited as the King Arthur tales were all based on real people and real events at some point in time. Although a lot of it got Latinized by the monks, and they changed the story a bit. And they actually did the same thing with Tirant le Blanc, because the original author of Tirant le Blanc died. Another author came in and wrote the middle half of the book, and then they think a third author actually came in, because a second author died, and wrote the third part of the book and finished it off. So and the books are clearly broken up into one section which deals with the knight's meeting with Tirant le Blanc, Count William of Warwick, and Count William teaches them all the rules of chivalry, et cetera, et cetera. And it's interesting that this book comes out in the 14th century, and the word chivalry itself stems from the same century with an unknown origin. But if you have this book, and it was so widely popular at the time that it was published all around the world, the known world at that time, and people knew this story, then it's obvious that there was some kind of sharing of information. So Chevron came from chivalry. Chivalry comes from this book, which is Tirant le Blanc, and that's tied back to Count William of Warwick, who tells him all about this stuff. And Count William of Warwick goes back to Warwickshire, Warwick Castle, the whole history of that, and then you get back into to King Arthur. And here's the interesting thing about King Arthur too. One of his symbols in art actually means in Welsh bear is that he was king of battle, or the leader of the battle, so to speak. And of course, war today, the where we have the, if all of these things are connected for Warwick, would tie all that back to the king of battle, meaning war. In addition to the fact that the present symbol of our family is a bear holding a tree or a spear. If you go back far enough, it's a spear. But today it's holding a tree trunk with seven branches cut off.
And what significance is that?
Oh, boy. Well, you have a couple of things that are associated with it. You have a saltire, which is the X, okay, which goes over the shield. Then you have seven arrowheads on the shield, which represent the Pleiades, or the seven stars, or the seven sisters. But the bear itself actually has a specific meaning that goes all the way back to around the 14th or the 15th century with Thomas Beauchamp, the Beauchamp family, who was the earls of Warwick. And what it was said was that the only information I could find on it right now...
We're going to have to hold up right there. I think he said it's a bear holding a tree trunk. It's got seven branches cut off. And then you were explaining the bear, as I think, as we went away for break.
Yeah, the bear actually is one of the proto cult civilizations that goes all the way back to before there were gods or anything. Mm-hmm. So most civilizations had a bear culture that predates all known forms of religion, you know, going back 10,000 years ago. So the bear is actually a very, very ancient symbol of, you could call them the Earth family, okay? Or those of us from the Earth that were, you know, based in the Earth or grounded in the Earth, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many other way to explain it. But it'll become maybe clearer a little bit later on as we get more involved with this. So the Grail families and the bear symbol, actually, in this particular case, after King Arthur and after the Christianization of Europe, everything had to go underground. And the murdering of Dagobert II, because you remember when Dagobert II was murdered, the Charlemagne said that all the Grail people, all the Grail descendants were dead, even though they weren't. But that was the image that was portrayed. So Charlemagne took over the Church of Rome and all that stuff, and basically the Grail families just kind of disappeared. But they didn't, of course.
All right, so with the Grail families, are we talking about the Merovingians?
Yes, basically the same thing. The interesting thing is that if you take M-E-R as a prefix, Merovingians, what does that actually mean? Well, Vingians, if you break up the word into maybe its French predecessors, not the word that we see today, but it'll be Mero or Mer, and then Vin, and then G, U, prefix again, another indication of sort of the lineage, so to speak, and then Merovingians. And you also find in the tombs of all the Merovingians, you're going to find two basic symbols. You're going to find bees, which are also associated with honey, and of course bears. Okay, and what was the other? I think it was the bees. So these were the sacred symbols of the Grail families: of bees, water, okay, bears, mm-hmm, and honey, or beehive. Okay.
All right.
So when the Grail family started to obviously designate themselves from other Grail families, they would use these symbols to designate branches of the family. So that's where the tree trunk with the seven branches cut off comes from. So there are all kinds of branches of the Grail family that are alive today. The church doesn't want you to know this or believe this, and that's why
you one?
Popularity.
Huh? Are you one?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you're alive today, so we have to take your word for it that they're alive. Okay, so when we say Grail family, let's define exactly what does that mean.
Oh, okay. All right. You are your mitochondrial DNA, which is passed down from mother to mother, can be traced back to, we'll call her Mary.
Magdalene.
No. Way before that. Oh, yes. You got to remember, Mary Magdalene, all the great leaders that were sent to Earth, all their mothers' names began with M.A. Just a variation of M.A.
Okay. So this Mary that you're talking about, that's way before Mary Magdalene, who is she?
Yes. Well, that's a very good question. The best that I have been able to determine is that she is most likely, and this is going to sound absolutely crazy, and it would take me probably an hour to explain how I came to this conclusion. But
I think I know who you're going to say, but go ahead.
If you want to know where she's from, my guess is going to be the Pleiades. And she is a part of the Atlantean interactions with extraterrestrials before the destruction of Atlantis, or the civilization of Atlantis, let's just call it that.
Okay.
And that she was part of an effort to breed certain characteristics, bad characteristics, out of the human beings that are around before us, because they had some genetic defects and some characteristics that were inherited from the Anunnaki, who are not from the Pleiades, but still are apparently human, of the human species.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned this from the Mayans. This is what I've come to understand from the Mayans, and how I was able to incorporate the information from the Mayans into what I already knew or understood about the Grail family.
So is this the one that the Mayans refer to as Pachamama?
Well, she's got 1,000 names. Mm-hmm. Probably. I'm not sure about that one in particular. God, I could just go on and on and on about this. But I call her Mary for the sake of that. That's the one most familiar to most people, and that's the one most people identify. Just think of Mother Mary. All right? You know, the mother of Mary was Mary. And who was her mother? And the thing is, as we know from science today, and here's the funny thing about this, the Grail families, okay, were a matriarchal lineage family. The reason why the current King of England, Prince Charles and his sons, had to marry, first of all, Diana, was because she was a Stuart. Now, Stuart is a Grail family, and Stuart is another name for Guardian. Guardian is another name is G-U-A-R. That's that Grail prefix that I was telling you about. The true name of the Grail prefix is G-U-A-R, or Guarensis. It's not Grail, it's Guar.
Okay.
G-U-A-R. So Guardian is that word. When you go back into the etymology of Guardian, you get Stu Ward, W-A-R-D. A ward or warden is the same thing as a guardian. And so what you figure out is that they're all kind of, there's a reason why these names have these prefixes, because they're denoting a specific sort of, you get the chivalric orders from them. You get, you know, the whole thing about the King Arthur tales and right and wrong and morals and, you know all of that stuff from the whole idea of the Grail family or the Grail lineage or King Arthur or whatever you want to call it. You know what I mean? They had to come up with a name for it, and that's the name that stuck. So I'm going to use the one that's most familiar to most people today, but I'm going to tell you what its real origin is. And I'll give you another example when we use, like, in, for instance, Freemasonry. A lot of people don't know what G stands for, even though they're in Freemasonry. You ask them what G, and they say it's for geometry or it's for God. But in fact, it's actually G for Guarensis. And remember, we're talking about the boomerang and the chevron symbols? Well, when you see a Freemason symbol, what is it? It's two boomerangs crossing each other with a G in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So now if you take the two boomerangs and you move them like this, then you get the X, you get the saltire, which is on the coat of arms. So for instance, on my coat of arms, we have the saltire, which is a veiled form of the two boomerangs crossing. If you go back further in time, I actually found a 15th century carving from, I don't want to say where it is because I'm afraid someone will destroy it, But I've actually got a picture of a 15th century carving with the two boomerangs touching in the middle but not crossing, which I have not been able to find a single representation of a coat of arms where the chevrons touch in the middle but they don't cross. They either go up like this, or they cross in the middle to make an X or a salt here, or they stack them, but that's it. I've never seen them in a carving in the middle. And the interesting thing about this carving, this picture, is that you have a cub, a bear cub, holding the Spear of Destiny, and then on the other side you have a unicorn, which is known as the universe. It's a very rare symbol in the coat of arms, and it's known as the symbol of Jesus Christ, the male side. So basically what you have is the unicorn representing the male side of the Grail family, and then you have the two chevrons crossing in the middle, which is the symbol of the Mary side of the family. See? So the Grail families inherited their royal lineage from the mother. It didn't matter who the father was. It mattered who the mother was. And this is also true in the Jewish tradition. It didn't matter who the father was. You inherited your Jewishness from the female side.
All right, so...
because of matriarchal DNA. Matriarchal DNA is only passed down from mother to daughter or from daughter to son. So if you didn't marry into the family, this is what they meant when the Grail chooses you. You see, you had to be worthy enough to be chosen by the woman to marry into the Grail family.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So when you drink from the chalice, okay, that means you're marrying into the family. You're copulating with, and you're having children with, which means you have everlasting life because they're the ones who are supposed to be protected. See?
All right, we got to take a break. I got questions about all that, as you would expect. All right, and we're talking this evening with William Warwick IV. He is an author. You can sum it up by saying he's a communicator. He's also an engineer. An entrepreneur, but he is a researcher, a writer, a speaker, has made films, and he's talking with us about these boomerang-shaped UFOs, or if you will, V-shaped or chevron-shaped UFOs, and the Grail families, and he's explaining some of the connection between those UFOs and these Grail families. In the course of doing that, William has said that he's traced his family and his family name back, and they are part of this these Grail families. Another word that has been used to describe Grail families is Merovingians. And they would, he said, the historians would like for you to think they're all dead. There's none of them alive today, but he's one. So, let me ask you, William, in with that respect, because of the Dan Brown novel that brought all this to everybody's big attention, you know, and he traces it back to Mary Magdalene. You say it right. You say it goes back way, way further than that.
Well, yeah.
Okay. So,
like the Spartans, for instance, on the Spartan shield, the Spartans worshipped Artemis, A-R-T, which is where we get the Arth from the Welsh. The Welsh got it from them, because yeah. Art means bear. So the cult of Artemis was a bear, a female goddess worshipping cult.
Okay.
And so they were a part of that, and their symbol was the chevron on the shield of the Spartans, which is called it's called the lambda. But where did the lambda come from? That, you know what I mean? It's like you start getting into this, and you go, "Wow, it's the symbol's always been there. The truth, the secret." They had something that actually Dan Brown alluded to partially in some of his information or information that was related to that. They would say like the secret is the key, and the key is the secret. Or the treasure is the key, and the key is the secret of the treasure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Basically, what it means is when you find the key, it opens up all the things. The key is the symbol of the chevron, period.
Okay. Here's the question. The question. Since the Church of Rome spent so much time and money and blood getting rid of Merovingians,
yeah.
And then here you are showing up and saying, "I'm one. Aren't you in danger?"
No, not at all.
Why not?
It's just, there's too many of us. They can't kill us all. So, it's just, it's ridiculed just like UFOs don't exist. It's funny, the two things in this world that do not exist and get ridiculed at face value is UFOs and the possibility of descendants of Jesus Christ or Mary Magdalene.
Okay, so as a Merovingian, you would be a descendant of Jesus Christ.
I wouldn't necessarily be a Merovingian because the Merovingian is just one branch of the family.
Oh, okay. All right.
Say the Merovingians are Grail. I'm Grail. It doesn't mean I'm a Merovingian.
I got you. So
see, go back. Hold on, just real quickly. Go back to the symbol of the tree trunk.
Mm-hmm.
The tree trunk has always been the symbol of genealogy going throughout history. When you see a picture of a tree in the old days, in fact, in Warwick Castles, there's a picture of a tree. And on each tree branch is the name of the families with their coat of arms.
Okay.
So now you understand where the symbology of the broken of the tree branches being cut off.
So when we talk about Grail families, we're talking about descendants of this woman from the Pleiades.
Exactly. Well, let's just call her Mary, the ultimate Mary.
Okay. All right. Now, and correct me if I'm wrong now, but it seems to me you're saying or implying that the connection between these V-shaped or chevron-shaped craft and the Grail families would be that these craft are coming from the same place and it's the same people of this original Mary.
Correct. We call it the Covenant.
And so she's from the Pleiades?
I think.
Okay. Well, for the sake of conversation, we'll say she is.
Yeah.
So she's from the Pleiades, and so these are craft of the Pleiadians. Is that correct?
They are the ones that found it, according to the Mayans, and according, you know, as you know, I'm a Mayan researcher and scholar, and I've been down there, and I've been initiated with them. And according to Wandering Wolf, the Pleiadians are the ones who actually founded each of the seven great civilizations. So Buddhism, the Chinese civilizations, Taoism, or Confucianism, whatever you want to call it, that whole philosophy string. We have Christianity with Jesus, and actually also Islam. Did I say Buddhism already?
Yeah.
Okay, so, and then I forget what the seventh was. I think it was
Judaism?
Zoroastrian.
Zoroastrian.
Oh, maybe it was Judaism. It could have been that. But, you know, you can almost take Judaism, Christianity, and mix them together, because the old book is the first part of the whole religion. So, you know what I'm saying? It's kind of...
Yeah, they're very, very, very related, very connected.
Well, in no offense to anyone's religious beliefs, but honestly, if as a scholar, if you read the Sumerian epics, which predate all of those, and then you read some of the Egyptian, Akkadian, et cetera, and you actually read those documents, the Epic of Gilgamesh, for instance, or the Enuma Elish, then you see quite clearly that the later versions of the Bible that we have today, the Old Testament especially, is a watered-down version of the Sumerian epics, period. End of story. No question, no doubt about it. The Sumerians predate them by a couple thousand years, and so it's kind of difficult for me to actually put too much emphasis or faith in those books because they've been tainted.
All right, so what's the significance of these boomerang-shaped craft showing up now?
Well, if the symbolism of Phoenix is definitely a message, because that was what always puzzled me. You know, why was it kind of clandestine here, and made sure that everyone in Phoenix saw it? And of course, Phoenix and March 13th. If you do a star chart for March 13th, what you're going to find for Phoenix, and actually for my location, you find almost a perfect star tetrahedron. Star tetrahedron, the Star of David. Another interesting connection that the reason why honeys are also associated with the bear families is because bees make honeycombs that are in a hexagon shape. The hexagon is the outline of a star tetrahedron. So that was one of the other reasons why honeys and bears and bees were all symbols of the Grail families, which has traditionally been known or looked at as the lineage of David, okay? If you look at it from a Judeo-Christian standpoint of view, but it's really much larger than that. It's really, really a way bigger worldwide sort of phenomenon. So it's not just, and this kind of ties back in with what the Wandering Wolf told us about the Pleiades, who had come down and founded the Karamaya, the Dragomaya, the Nagamaya. Each of the seven great civilizations that we have a Maya prefix in their language, that an M-A-Y-A language. And again, we come back to Mary. Well, what's the connection between Mary and the Maya? Well, it's the M-A prefix. Wherever you look, you see the M-A prefix. So that's why I came up with Mother Mary, Mother Maya, however you want to look at it.
Okay, but here we're now down to 2013.
Yes.
And all of this stuff is happening.
Sorry, I didn't answer your question. I don't mean to cut you off, and I do want to answer that question. I think it's because they're trying to show us and encourage us, and by witnessing these events to certain people. There was an old saying that, you know, many are called, few are chosen. Well, what does that mean? You know, how many people saw those UFOs that might have been descendants of...
I don't know. It sounds like a casting call for a movie to me.
I mean, really.
Many were called, but only a few got chosen.
That's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. So, and then that's what really drove me on, like, why me? Because, and I think I told you this before, if I had woken up the day after I saw this UFO and there were 2,700 people reported this thing, et cetera, I never would have investigated the way that I did. It was only because I was fired from my job. It was only because, you know, I had had so many experiences, you know, before that and after that, that I was able to connect the dots, so to speak, and really was in the right place at the right time in a way that's just difficult to kind of explain here. It'll come out in the book, but there were so many connections that were tied to this event that led to learning so many things that it never would have happened if I hadn't seen the UFO. So,
all right, but I still have a question about, so yeah. What? I mean, and I don't mean that in a rude way. I mean that in a quite literal way. They're showing up. Okay, and?
Well, to answer your question, if I hadn't seen that UFO, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about the connection between boomerang UFOs in history and the Grail families, or the fact that there is a Grail family, or that I could tell you what the real name of the Grail is and tell you how King Arthur and who wrote the book and how chivalry and the name Chevron came about and tie all these things together. So, really,
okay, but that brings us still to and? So what does that mean for us in 2013 or 14 or 15 in the years ahead? What is this leading up to?
The synthesis that I think I've definitely come to the conclusion is that, and Wandering Wolf, who's the Mayan leader, actually kind of said this as well, was that we are to bring together the seven branches. In other words, there's a Grail lineage in every branch, so to speak.
Okay.
Okay? So the seven great religions are going to have to come together and basically become not one, but part of the same tree. And I've come to the realization that was why we had the symbol of the seven branches being cut off, because we're supposed to put those branches together on the same tree again.
Well, you got your work cut out for you, man, because some of those religions teach they are the only one, and by golly, if you don't accept that, we'll cut your head off.
Well, you know, I mean, specifically for Islam, sure, but you know, and again, you know, the question is what elements of each religion do you want to keep that are good, and which are the ones that you just want to let fall by the wayside? And obviously there are extremists in every single religious belief system. I mean, every religious belief system is a cult, right? I mean, basically, right?
I consider them all fiction.
Exactly. So
that's, and let me say to my audience, that's my personal opinion. I understand that much of my audience has a completely different opinion about that, and I respect that. My personal opinion is, for me, religion is fiction.
Well, my personal feeling on religion is that you can find truth in religion, but not all religions are true. So I think, hate to say this, but even in something like Satanism, you know, you could find some elements of what you might call truth. It doesn't mean that the whole package is correct or right. And just like Christianity, you know, you could find elements in it that are true, that you could apply to any religion.
Well, I agree that truth is truth wherever you find it.
Right, exactly.
I maintain I can find it absent of all the religious trappings.
True. Well, without the, what's the word? Not culture, but the dogma. the dogma.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I think we're getting a little bit off base, but I mean the
well, no,
the bottom
we're,
line,
no, we're not. I'm you're answering, and we're getting there. The question of so what's the goal here? What does it mean?
Right. What's the synthesis of all this? Well, that's what I'm trying to explain to you, is that it's the slow and gradual release of this information, so that people begin to realize that they have more in connection with each other than they thought. I mean, really, the whole idea of these Catholic Church and these religious systems is really to divide us. Men took religion and used it as a tool to divide us and keep us in constant warfare with each other so that they could have more power and control. And so another interesting thing is one of the things I found was sans guarensis. Where, like, they translated Grail as sans Grail, but if you do sans guarensis, it basically means without war. So it means to rule without war. Maybe that's one of the reasons why they changed from guarensis to Grail, so that people would not get the idea that you could rule without war. So,
well,
this is a really deep, deep thing, because when you introduce warfare into society, then you introduced all of the bad things that we still have today that are keeping us, that are killing us today.
We're electing those.
Well, that's true, but I'm saying it started a long time ago. Another interesting thing is the word war. Because obviously I wanted to find out what WAR stood for, since where did GUR come from? Well, WAR is actually from around the time that Dagobert II was assassinated. It's around the 7th or 8th century Germanic prefix. And it basically means to confuse. And when I did research on that, what it was the feudal lords decided or figured out that instead of fighting with the peasants who owned the land, they would create some stupid thing, and they would have a war with their person next door, right? You know, the feudal lord next door to them, and then the people that were all riled up against the king would now be riled up against the other king, and not so much paying attention to what was going on, or the fact that they were getting, you know, not a good deal with their king. And so these feudal systems derived from the sense that they would keep the people in a constant state of were, W-E-R, the original word, and that means to confuse them.
So these were Grail families that started doing that?
No, it's actually after Dagobert II was assassinated that Charlemagne was the one that basically instituted that in a way, I think. Although it happened before that. I mean, warfare has been with us for a long time. But I think institutionalized warfare is not. Whereas from that point forward, you know, that's why it was called the documents. So from that point forward, you get the military orders coming around in 1100, which is the Knights Templar. Obviously, the Roman Church said, whoa, we don't want that. You guys, no. If it's going to be that, we need to be in control of it. And that's why they disbanded the Knights Templar, who are actually not just the protectors of the lineage of Jesus Christ, they were the lineage of Jesus Christ. That's another thing that a lot of people don't understand or know. So they were the Grail family. That's why they went to such lengths to just exterminate them. Not all of them, of course, but I'm saying the core, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, was the one who founded the order, which became the Knights Templar. Well, Saint Bernard, B-E-R-N, any B-E-R-N prefix means bear.
All right, so they got rid of all of these Grail families. How did some survive?
Well, the Freemasons.
I don't get it. How did the Freemasons make them survive?
Well, they didn't kill all the Grail families. They just suppressed them whenever they got out of control, whenever they decided they were going to take power or control. So when the Knights Templars got too powerful, they disbanded them. And then a couple of centuries later, in the 17th century, all those Knights Templars that went up to Scotland and England, mostly Scotland, decided they're going to start their own organization kind of based on the Knights Templar called Scottish Masonry, Freemasonry. Mm-hmm. And that was imported back into America through the colonies. And then what happened was the French Freemasons, because there were French Freemasons too, again, Grail families, French Grail families, and American Grail families, American Freemasons got together against the British. So really that whole, you know, the fight for the Civil War with America was really a battle between the French and the American Freemasons against the British Freemasons, who had the most power and control.
And so why were they fighting with each other as Freemasons?
Because we don't all agree on the same thing.
Okay. So what my line of questioning is leading to is this. Why should we think we're going to get a good deal out of the Grail families rising again?
Oh, it's not going to rise. It's going to be the realization en masse of millions of people around the world that everything that we've been told before was a lie, and that there is the potential of hope. Because I think deep down inside, everyone knows that this story is true. And if they don't know it, they want it to be true, right?
So, I don't know yet. You know, I'm not sure what I think about Grail families. I mean, seriously, you know, if this is where all of the religions of the world came from, I don't have a very good opinion of them. Seriously.
I'm sorry, if you think that the Grail families are where all the religions came from?
The Pleiadians planted all of the seven religions and seven civilizations.
Whoa, wait. They sent messengers to help teach us.
Okay.
What happened after the messengers left, when men got involved with it, is a whole other story.
Okay, so the religions are man-made fiction based on...
Correct.
Whatever messenger was here.
What you might call the ultimate truths.
Okay.
So you could take any of these seven great religions, like Buddhism, for instance, and you could break it down into 10 or 15 different ultimate, we'll call them ultimate truths. You could take Christianity, break it down in Hebrew into 10 commandments, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, every one of these religions started off as trying to give just a few ultimate truths. And it was when men tried to interpret those ultimate truths that we got this confusion. You see?
I agree with that.
So for instance, in the Torah specifically, it was always specifically said that you had to copy each letter of the Torah, you know, to the letter. Don't change a thing. Don't interpret it. Don't change it. Don't do anything. Because they were of the idea that they would be able, you know, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Whereas Christianity, forget it. I mean, they wrote up whatever they wanted to write, you know?
Yeah. Well,
spade stuff up.
Well, when I say that I think religion is fiction, I've based that on exactly what you've described. Let's say, we'll just for simplification, we'll say there is God, and we'll say God spoke. Somebody wrote it down. Okay. Got no problem with this. My problem is the first guy that comes along and says, now what that means, folks, is... Now, there's your problem. That's a theologian, yeah. And that's where the fiction comes from. And yeah. Then you have other people that come along and say, no, it means this. And someone else says, well, it means this. And whichever one of those winds up being the most powerful starts a seminary. And then they teach all of their followers in the seminary their version of that. And then eventually we come down through the centuries and you have all these denominations, both of Judaism and Christianity, and you have denominations of Islam, and it's all that same process how we got here. And that's what I'm saying is fiction. Is that once you have somebody stand up and tell you, now this really means this, and you go, oh yeah, okay. Well, at that point, you've accepted fiction. It means everything that it means. The original teaching, whatever it was, means what it means. And here's how that works. You and I go into a restaurant. We both order exactly the same meal. It comes out of the same pan in the kitchen. It's exactly the same, but it isn't. Because when you eat it, your body's going to take from it what your body needs. My body is going to take what my body needs. And those are different. If you could analyze those chemically, that's different. My body needs different things from that meal than yours does. But it was the same meal. It just meant something different to you than it means to me. So which one of us is right? Yeah. Both
well,
of us.
And that's why, and specifically when you talk about religious documents, you always want to try to get to the earliest source, you know, the Q document, so to speak.
Yeah. All right, caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Steve from Georgia.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, and hey, Mr. Warwick. Interesting work you're doing there, and I'm quite sure that you've done more than you can express within the limited framework of this show. But I'd like to suggest something about the bear, that you may be shortchanging the bear. The constellation of the bear is where the Big Dipper is, and yes. it has been a very famous constellation, you know, for a long time. In the Odyssey, Odysseus praised the Ursa Major, you know, he praised the yes. Great Bear as the one constellation that was always visible in the northern skies. You know, the others would sink below the ocean. This would never go away. In early theosophical research, I want to say that Madame Blavatsky had said that the Pleiades receive energy from the galactic core and break it down into the rainbow, the seven vibrational tones, and send it to the seven stars of the Great Bear. And then from the Great Bear, it goes to Sirius, then to the Sun, then to the Earth, and then it winds up being the DNA of human beings. You know, and that we have our source at the galactic center, coming through the Pleiades to the Great Bear. You know, anyway, all that. Now, you know, Kevin, you asked a question. So what? You know, what does all this mean? I think all this is very pertinent because of the fact that we're moving into the galactic plane, or not moving into, but we are there. And because of that, I think we are catching more of what our galaxy, our galactic core, thinks, you know, because I believe planets are alive, people are alive. I believe that the galaxy and the galactic core is a living being beyond anything that we would even conceive of as life. It's just amazing. And it has neighbors. It considers its neighbors the neighboring galaxies. You know, the same way I consider my neighbors the people next door.
So are we like the amoeba in the galaxy cesspool?
well, not exactly the amoeba. We might be the amoeba, but we have the potential to be much more. And the point is, I think we're starting to see a lot of these phenomena, like these Chevron spacecraft, Chevron UFOs and so on, simply because we are into the galactic center, so we're going to be catching more of the galactic communication.
Okay. Well, even like the Mayans, what the Mayans said was that we're, you know, that time actually goes in cycles, number one, and number two, that you sort of have expanding time cycles and shortening time cycles. One of the things that they said that we're reaching into right now with the 13th Bach tune is that, and the difference between one Bach tune and another is that time itself, so to speak, is actually accelerating 20 times faster than the previous Bach tune. So, and you could apply this to safe information exchange, like right now. I mean, we're exchanging information right now across the world in ways that we've never been able to do it before. There could be someone calling in from halfway across the world right now and exchanging ideas in a way that's 20 times faster, really, than it was during the previous Bach tune. The idea that all of us can sort of come together as a raising of the level of consciousness could only really happen, so to speak, and I think they realized this after we passed through, like you said, the galactic synchronization. And how does that affect us on a molecular level? And can the planets really have influences on us, even though we're not tied to them gravitationally? If you go into something like quantum physics, and one of my companies is Innovative Nanotechnology Solutions, so I know a little bit about this, you get it to like quantum entanglement. where one particle can be here and another particle can be across, you know, halfway across the universe, and that they can exchange information between each other. So, you know, definitely we have, you know, the more we learn about physics, the more it seems like magic, and we can definitely learn a lot from expanding our minds about these things, especially the UFOs. And you know, Kevin, to speak more definitively towards what you were saying, what is the synthesis of all this? I think it's the raising of the level of consciousness very slowly. It's like a pressure cooker. And if you really begin in 1997, you look at the number of national news stories that were done on UFOs, it might have only been two or three or four or five. And if you actually look at the number of national news stories and you count them since 1997, they are growing exponentially. So it really is a process, I think, of raising the consciousness and doing it in such a way that it's not going to freak people out. So, you know, you look at Dan Brown's novel coming out in 2004. Well, Brown is actually a girl family name because Brown is an English name, and actually Brown is another name for the bear, and the symbol of the Brown family from England is a bear as well. So go figure.
Well, you know, I agree with you that consciousness is being raised, but I'd like to throw a caveat in there that I think those whose consciousness will be raised is being raised, and those who will not, their consciousness will not.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it definitely seems to be sort of, well, and like the Hopi call this the time of the great purification for a reason. You know, I think we're reaching a certain level with everything where we're going to have to make some really hard decisions about everything, social engineering, social systems, you know, how we eat, how we dress, how we use energy, all of that's going to have to be radically changed, and have to be changed fast, like in the next 20 years, because if we don't really have some radical change...
I'm not going to wear shoes.
We're going to lose the biosphere. It's that simple. This is our spaceship. It's called Spaceship Earth.
I've never done this, but I am going to prove it. I don't wear shoes when I do this show.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I'm barefooted every show. I just held my foot up for the camera. I hate shoes.
Well, Kevin, we got to make a hard decision. Off their shoes.
Yeah, if we got to make a hard decision about the way we dress, and that includes shoes, count me out. I'm a dinosaur. I'm not wearing the shoes. I hate shoes.
Well, thank you for
Kevin,
your comments.
I
appreciate you bringing
up the
Ursa
Major. Part of the order of the new
stuff.
Day.
You guys were talking on top of each other, so I couldn't understand either one of you. So you go, Steve.
Okay, I think taking off the shoes is going to be part of the order of the day.
I hope so.
You know,
I hope everybody
joins. Ground ourselves. If you've ever heard of grounding, you got to stand with your bare feet on the ground in order to channel energy to the earth the way it's supposed to go. I'm not wearing shoes either, Kevin.
Well, hallelujah.
You know, totally off base here, guys. It's funny that you mentioned that, because I had just seen something, I don't know if it was on the internet or something, but it was talking about how you should take your shoes off and touch the ground for something like an hour or two a day, and it literally changed, you know, the polarity of, you know, how electromagnetic waves would either travel over you because you were grounded, or whether those electromagnetic waves would come through you because you're not grounded.
All right, so it's your turn. You got your shoes on there, William?
Actually, no, I don't. Not at all.
All right, there you go.
But I'm not touching the ground. I'm sitting upstairs in my renovated castle up here.
All right. Okay. Back to something. I think there is something to all of that. But back to something a little more on target with what we're talking about. Both of you seem to agree that the so what in this is that consciousness is being raised.
Yes. Let me put it to you another way. This is the second coming of Christ. The second coming of Christ is not necessarily the physical coming of Christ, but it is the teachings of Christ himself. The main core tenets of, you know, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt turn the other cheek, thou shalt not, you know, murder, etc., etc. I mean, basic, very simple ideas. But we've lost track of that. You know, we've really lost track of our Christianity. We've lost track of our Judaism, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We've forgotten who we are as a people because we've got all these stupid interpretations that confuse us.
And I don't have any problem with thou shalt not kill. I'm out of cheeks, though. I'm just going to warn everybody. It ain't going to be turned. If you smack me, you're going to get it.
Well, I mean, do you know what I'm saying? You could actually, again, you could take that philosophy to, like, the Buddhism philosophy, one of the seven branches, who is all about, you know, pacifism. So,
And I pretty much am. You know, when I'm not 100% a pacifist. But
here's the funny. The way it was interpreted, the way I interpreted what Wandering Wolf said was that there were seven great religions, meaning the seven great lights of Earth, which is, like we said before, Judaism, et cetera, et cetera, and that we were supposed to take the synthesis of those things and still kind of keep them as our own sort of cultural background, but still come to an agreement on a certain sort of, you know, universal brotherhood or universal constitution or universal bill of rights.
Yeah. Steve, you have another question or comment?
Oh, no, I'm good, and I appreciate you taking my call, and thank you, Mr. Warrick, for the hard work that you do.
I appreciate it, too. Thank you for listening, and if you ever want to follow some of the work that we do, I publish a lot on WikileaksUFOs.com, which is actually a Facebook page.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. 623-444-5889, 623-444-5889. And if you'd like to talk to someone who's part of the Grail families, well, this is your opportunity. Give us a call with your question or your comment. My thing with shoes, people, I'm sure the world over, think, man, that's quirky. It may be, but I'm healthier if I don't wear them. And I feel better. There are places where I have to. I mean, if I go to a restaurant, I have to wear shoes. That's a rule. That's a law. I bend to it. I wear the shoes because I want the food. And, I always like those signs on the door that say, no shirt, no shoes, no service. Right? And so, okay, they don't say anything about wearing pants. So what if you put on shirts and shoes and take your pants off? Will you get service? You know, interesting stuff. Interesting stuff from the bent brain of Kevin Smith. All right, so the consciousness thing. See, a whole lot of folks think that there was going to be like this one big flash of light and consciousness was going to be raised. You're saying it's gradual.
Yeah. Absolutely. Because if it's too fast, people can't adapt. You know, they can't assimilate it. And really, that's really, if you can actually think of Jesus, who was really Horus and Isis. There were pharaohs. There was the Egyptian pharaoh and the queen pharaoh. That's who they really were. But we call them Jesus and Mary.
All right, we're on final approach. We only have a few minutes left in tonight's show. And for that reason, William, instead of coming back to what you were saying there about Horus and Isis, let's take this call, and then if we have time, you and I will come back to that. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Charlotte, and I just have a comment. Seven religions, seven civilizations. It reminds me of the
Charlotte. Tell us
Christian
what
religion, the Baha'i religion.
Charlotte.
Much the same thing.
Charlotte, can you hear me?
Yes.
You didn't tell us where you're from.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Silver Spring.
Maryland or New Mexico
Maryland.
Maryland. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So the seven religions. What now?
It reminds me of the Baha'i religion. They taught that in the middle of the 19th century, I believe. The progressive revelation and the continuous, you know, and it doesn't stop. One of the reasons why they get corrupted is because they're local and not everyone can accept it. They can become universal. But I also wanted to ask a question about the Merovingians and why is it significant, these physical descendants of Jesus? What purpose were they supposed to have?
Well, it's basically the promulgation of the tenets of, say, for instance, like chivalry, or in particular, which is more geared towards a military, you know, sort of code of ethics. And really, if you go back to, for instance, like the Magna Carta, and the original, you know, people that sort of wrote that, well, I mean, they're basically all Grail families. And the Magna Carta, of course, is the progenitor of you know, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, et cetera, et cetera. So
I remember we used to have those. Yeah.
So it was an overall, the purpose was an overall sort of education, so to speak, and teaching and trying to lead in a spiritual way, I think, you know, people towards what we call light or knowledge or scientific reason, so to speak. All of these things, I think, is what they were actually, you know, geared towards doing. It's basically bringing us out of the, you know, the cesspool that we were in. And teach. I'll give you an example. The first thing that they taught us was to baptize ourselves. Now, we consider it a religious event, but actually 2,000 years ago, the idea of washing yourself every day in clean water was a way to get rid of a lot of diseases and bacteria and all kinds of things to make people healthy. So although we see it as a religious thing that was brought to us, it was actually brought to us to clean us, to make us more healthy. And we call that baptism today in the Jews and
well,
the Christians practice.
Well, metaphors often have a physical sort of backup.
Mm-hmm.
They mean things in two different ways. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank
Welcome.
You so much. She's right. And that was my point. My problem with religion is all religion is man-made. And that doesn't mean I have a problem with the truths that they are trying, or that may be contained in that religion. I don't have a problem with that. My problem is all those other ornaments and dogmas and crap that gets hung on it to make it a religion. That's all man-made. And a person, you take any truth, that truth is going to have an impact on you that's different than the impact it will have on me. Just like a meal, if we eat the same meal, that meal has a different impact on your body than it has on mine. Your body takes what it needs, mine takes what I need. And I think our particular level of psychological and spiritual development is all different, just like our bodies are all different and have different needs. And so you get one thing out of a truth, somebody else gets another thing, and a religionist says, oh no, it means this. This is the meaning. No, it means what it means to the person who encounters it. That's my point. I don't expect anybody to believe that, buy that, whatever. That's just my view of it. All right, so let's go back. We have about 3 minutes here.
Well, and one interesting one, just to cap it off, you know, Kevin, is that the Grail, you know, the whole idea of the Grail, it really doesn't have a religious, you know, sort of belief or connotation that comes with it. I mean, I guess you could call it a Christian religion, but it's not really. It's really more Gnostic than it is Christian. And so, you know, you don't necessarily have to give up your belief system or believe in anything else, maybe other than the boomerang UFOs and how they interact with the Grail families. I mean, that's really the only leap of faith that I see personally. So the rest of it is just history.
I mean, how do they interact?
Well, that's where we come back to the point of being initiated. When I was doing some of the research on Rennes Le Chateau and the families there, I found out that all the families' names had a bear connotation. And I could go into it and into it, even going to Fatima and Lourdes and all
okay,
of
but
that.
Okay, but the interaction of the UFOs with
is to initiate the Grail seeker or the Grail family person or whoever that particular person is to initiate them.
Okay, it sort
just
of
like
gets,
just like I was initiated.
It kind of gets your attention and gets you started on the path.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Exactly. I would even go further to say that subsonic wave hum, which I've heard three times, mm-hmm. and was somehow triggering something genetically, memory-wise, whatever you want to call it, that triggered a lot of memories coming back and a lot of sort of, you know. So it's an initiation not only in the sense that you saw it and then you know that it's real and that other things, you know, leads you mm-hmm. to other things, but I think that might have been the reason why it was so close to me, because I could have been much further away and not heard or felt the hum at all. So why was it so close to that it could actually affect me? And I think that might also play something into it.
I would think that it would have some effect on you. You know, my work in music is work with sound, and I guarantee you, a good writer, a good composer, can make you feel anything he wants you to feel. Any emotion he wants you to feel, he can make you feel that with how he writes that music and then how it's played. And they do it in the movies. You take a movie that makes you cry and take the music out of it. See if you cry then. Probably not.
I actually saw a scientific explanation of how the way sound vibrations work, in that the higher the frequency, the more interference waves hit the DNA strand. Mm-hmm. The lower the frequency, the larger the distance between waves, the less hits on the DNA strand it gets in a given strand of DNA. Mm-hmm. So when you get into the higher frequencies of energy, you actually are able to hit more, or maybe, so to speak, trigger more parts of the DNA strands. Because like 70% of our DNA is basically useless as far as we know right now. You know, only like 26, 30, 40%, something like that, is actually key DNA that actually makes us who we are. The rest of it is just transcription errors that they call them transcription errors. But it could just be that those are unlocked sequences of DNA that have yet to be unlocked or unraveled.
William, every time you're on, we run out of time before we run out of stuff to talk about. But it's always deep. It's always interesting, and I want to thank you for being with us this evening. And if you will, stay on the line with me for a moment as I bring this in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, William Warrick IV. And I just said it. It is always interesting. It is always deep. It's always way, way more there than we can get to in a show. So we will have him back. I want to thank everybody who has been here tonight. You've been listening around the world. Thank you. Thanks to all of our affiliate stations for carrying the show. You're wonderful. And thank you to those who called in. We did have some flash messages, but they came from the USA and they get automatically deleted. Which means, of course, I don't ever get to see those. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You may call me whatever you wish to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.